It's time for a solid hour of Tea Party Power. And now, here's Janine Garofalo's favorite teabagging rednecks. Mark Galar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. We are honored to have Charles Murray with us this morning. He is the author of Coming Apart, The State of White America from 1690 to 2010. Charles, welcome to the show.
1960 to 2010, Mark. Okay. I don't go back as far as 1690. I'm delighted to be on the show.
It's one of those mornings. I apologize.
I sympathize.
That would be a heck of a book. Well, tell us about the book. Are we really coming apart? Is the middle class disappearing?
It's not that the middle class is disappearing. It's that we have reached a cultural divide that is unprecedented in our history, which involves what I call a new upper class and a new lower class. And the subtitle of the book, The State of White America, 1960 to 2010, is for a reason. I want to focus the concentration of my readers. I don't want them to listen to these problems and say, oh, well, he's really talking about African Americans or he's talking about Latinos. I want them to understand that this cultural division has affected non-Latino whites and creates a major problem for the future.
Okay, so we're not suggesting that other races aren't having a similar divide. It's just that for this particular book, you wanted to focus on white America.
That's right. And in fact, I have a chapter toward the end where I say, okay, I'm now going to expand the data to include everybody, all ethnicities, all races, and guess what? The picture looks the same. But I can do that at that point because I've already made completely clear to my readers that the problems I'm talking about are extremely serious in the white population.
Well, some people might look at this and say, you know, Charles, we've always had class differences in America. What's the big deal? This is nothing new.
Yeah, it's really new. Let me give you an example.
Okay.
If you go back to 1960 and looked at really successful people at that time, the only thing they had in common was the fact they were successful. Here, I'll give you an example. You had John F. Kennedy's cabinet. Well, it had two upper-class people. It had a guy named Douglas Dillon, who was a member of the establishment, and it had Bobby Kennedy, who was a rich guy. The rest of that cabinet were born to sons of immigrants who worked in blue-collar jobs. They were the sons of farmers. They were sons of small business owners, merchants, and so forth. They had grown up in America, in mainstream America, and they brought to their success memories of that. So they might have been in the cabinet, but they were thoroughly grounded in what I would call mainstream America. You look at it now, and it's changed completely. You look at successful people, they are disproportionately the most successful in politics and government and the media and so forth, have often gone to elite colleges. They've certainly gone to college. They have been socialized in a certain kind of culture that is different from mainstream America in everything from the way they raise their kids to the kinds of foods they eat to the cars they buy to the schools they send their kids to. I could go through a whole litany of ways in which they don't participate in mainstream America, don't watch the same TV shows, don't watch the same movies. We have a successful upper class now which lives in a world of its own. And I don't want to continue this answer too long, Mark, but just I'll
That's
add
okay.
one other thing we can talk about more later. They also tend to live in enclaves and zip codes which are filled with other people like themselves, and they have very little contact with anybody who's not part of that world.
So when we hear stories of Barack Obama and Bill Ayers living just a few feet from each other, you know, is this what you're talking about?
I mean, yeah, that's right. That's right. And you may know Michael Barone, the newspaper columnist, and he's on TV a lot. He talked to me once about his neighborhood in Washington. He's from Harvard undergraduate and Yale Law School, and he said, well, the people next door, they were from Princeton. The people on the other side of me were from Yale. The people across the street from me were from Harvard. He said, just your typical American neighborhood. And what he was talking about was the degree to which his Washington neighborhood where he lived was in this kind of bubble. Yeah, it happens a lot.
Well, you know, it's hard to even look at the title of your book without thinking of Occupy Wall Street and the Tea Party. There is some anger at the elite, but I mean, is that a manifestation of what you're talking about here?
Well, actually, the Tea Party is too.
Yeah.
The Tea Party comes at it from, as I understand it, from a point of view of saying, look, we have a power elite in our politics that doesn't understand the rest of America and is out of touch. And the way I understand Occupy Wall Street is that they're really upset about the 1%, the richest 1%.
Mm-hmm.
And both the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street have a hold of an aspect of the problem. But money isn't really it. Look, if you have a guy who's made $50 million because he has a successful string of auto repair shops,
mm-hmm.
that he's devised, first place, very few Americans are upset at him for making that money. He made it by providing a service people wanted to buy. And the second thing is, he doesn't have any power over other people's lives except to provide them with good auto repair. He doesn't affect the movies you see or the television shows you see. He
mm-hmm.
doesn't affect regulations in Washington. So it's not just money that makes a difference. If, on the other hand, you have an attorney living in Northwest Washington who is a lobbyist for one of the major special interests, that guy doesn't have $50 million. He's affluent, but he has a lot of influence in the way with his job over things that will affect the rest of America. And that lobbyist, taken large, in large numbers of people, run the country, and they're the ones in this bubble.
So it's really more about, at least with the Tea Party, in your opinion, it's more about being out of the loop when it comes to the decision-making and feeling that a lot of things are beyond our control.
Well, heavens knows I shouldn't be telling you about the Tea Party, but I'll tell you my own understanding. My own understanding.
No, I'm getting your take.
Yeah, my take is, first, I think the Tea Party is one of the more miraculous things that has happened in the United States. It came out of nowhere. It was not organized by the political elites. And I know that the New York Times tells me that the Tea Party is a bunch of racists and homophobes. That's not what I hear.
The Koch brothers, I apologize for interrupting, but the Koch brothers are funding us 100%. Every day we all go to the mailbox to get our check from the Koch brothers. But in fact, I had a guest on recently who actually believes that. So, but go ahead, I'm sorry.
I just wanted to finish that. What I hear from the rhetoric of the Tea Party is that they believe in limited government of the sort that George Washington and Thomas Jefferson believed in, and that I believe in. And I think that the movement is extremely. I'm a big fan of the Tea Party in that regard. And I also hear from the rhetoric of the Tea Party that they look at people in both the Republican and the Democratic parties in Washington and say they don't get it. They don't understand that we're not talking about tweaking the welfare state a little bit here and there or tweaking the regulatory state a little bit here and there. We want to have a government which leaves people free to live their lives as they see fit, as long as they don't bother anybody else. Is that a pretty accurate statement?
I think you've got it right on the money, Mr. Murray. I think it's an excellent description of what the Tea Party is all about. In fact, while you were describing that, I thought back to some of the Tea Parties I've attended where people were holding signs that said, Bush was part of the problem, too. Republicans are part of the problem, too.
Yeah.
We see that a lot. And, in fact, some of them were more blunt, and they had signs up that said Republicans suck, too. But that's something, and I don't know that I've seen anything at an Occupy Wall Street meeting that says, Democrats are part of the problem. But, you've hit it on the head. And what's interesting is how this group has been vilified by the mainstream media. Like you said, according to the New York Post, we're a bunch of racists, even though we were wildly behind Herman Cain before he dropped out due to some, we'll call them, personal problems. And, I just think you'll find equal support for Alan West should he decide to run for president someday, yet we're portrayed as racist. And in the meantime, we've got people like Joe Biden who can say that Barack Obama is America's first clean, good-looking, articulate black man, and Harry Reid can say that Barack Obama is a light-skinned black who doesn't have an African-American accent unless he wants one, and Barack Obama can refer to his own grandmother as a typical white woman, but it's the Tea Partiers who are racist. And I didn't mean to go on. I mean, I've got a litany of these things, but there are so many examples of racism on the part of the left. I find it ironic that a handful of signs at Tea Parties, and yes, there were some people who joined the Tea Party for the wrong reason initially, but a handful of signs has been used to categorize 20% of the American electorate, which we eliminated those people from our ranks very, very quickly once they began to show themselves for what they really were. But let me ask you this. Is there a solution to this? I mean, can the bridge between the classes ever be built?
Well, let's add something in before we get to that question mark, if you don't mind, because we've been talking about the new upper class. Mm-hmm. We have got a real problem with the new lower class, too. And I think that it's really useful, especially for your listeners, to come to grips with that. And that is, in white America, we have gotten a cultural divide on the bottom that is really scary. Let me give you a couple of examples. Suppose we're talking about working-class white America. And by that, I mean no more than a high school education, working in a blue-collar occupation, or a low-skill service occupation, something like that. Working-class jobs as we've always understood them. Mm-hmm. That's about 30% of white adults, so it's a good chunk of the population.
Sure.
Now think about something like marriage. 1960, white working-class America behaved just about the same as white upper-middle-class America with regard to marriage. Just about everybody was married after they were mature adults. As of 2010, the percentage of white working-class Americans ages 30 to 49 who are married is down to 48%. That's less than half. And I don't know what size town you come from or live, but I think anybody
I'm in College Station.
College Station? Okay. Yeah. It makes a huge difference in how neighborhoods function when you don't have nearly as many people married. When you have a minority of adults married, and it makes a huge difference in whether you can get people to coach the little league team, whether you have people engaged in solving problems in the community. Let me give you another example. Again, now I'm talking about white males in working class occupations with high school education, ages 30 to 49. Males are supposed to work, and that was true in 1960. It's true in 2010. If you're an adult male, you should be out there working. And in 1960, again, almost everybody either was working or they were trying to find a job, one of the two.
Mm-hmm.
As of 2008, before the recession, so I'm not talking about things caused by the recession, before the recession, about one out of eight white males ages 30 to 49 with that kind of education weren't even looking for jobs.
Wow.
And not only that, when you talk to them, it's not the case that they're discouraged workers, say, gee, there's nothing out there. We're talking about years in the 1990s and the 2000s and the 1980s when there were help wanted signs up all over the country. So you have a major problem now of cultural differences that exist now that didn't exist before. There used to be a common civic culture in this country that tied everybody together, whether you were a lawyer or whether you were an electrician. You were part of the same culture, and that's changed, and that's scary.
Let me ask you this, getting back to marriage. Have we reached a point where the younger generations just don't even see it as something that's required? Because I have lost count of the number of people that I've heard make reference to their baby daddy or their baby mama. It's getting ridiculous.
Here's another pretty stunning number. Historically, there's been a lot of worry about babies born out of wedlock, but it's been usually we talk about the African-American community where it's been very high. Well, I'll tell you something. Among white women who are high school graduates or less, 48% of their babies are now born without a husband. And that was in 2008, so we're probably over half now, okay?
Well, I saw a survey, Dr. Murray, that something like 65% of high school girls said that there was nothing wrong with having a baby out of wedlock, and the percentage was a little lower for males. But, you know, I'm still waiting for Hallmark to put out the, you know, Baby Daddy Day and Baby Mama Day cards because I think we're headed there.
Okay, so Mark, here's – okay, now I was just talking about this point, white girls with a high school education, all right? You go up the ladder, how about white girls with a college education?
Sure.
Maybe 8, 7, 8, 9% of their children are born out of wedlock. A huge cultural divide again. So you have one part of America where marriage is alive and well, the work ethic is alive and well. And by the way, your listeners should understand, I'm obviously not talking about everybody. In fact, for your listeners who are in working class jobs themselves, all I'm asking them to do is look around at their own neighborhoods. And they may be working hard at their job. They may be married. Tell me this. Are you having a problem in your community because of all the people in your community who are not married and who are living off their sisters and living off their girlfriends? And I have a feeling that with listeners who are in that situation, I'm going to get a lot of them who say, damn right, I know exactly what he's talking about. It's out there.
I think we see it all the time. It's just that our morals have changed. I think I've seen situations numerous times where a young single girl will announce to her office place, I'm having a baby, and everybody's like, oh, that's so great, that's fantastic, when's it due? And there was a time, and I'm not suggesting that this is the way it should be, but there was a time when single females would leave town to have the babies. You know, back in the 50s, it was just considered something wrong. I can tell you, as a young high school student at a new high school, I was asked by a teacher to run an errand down in the basement to the cosmetology lab. I was brand new. I had to find my way there. And when the door opened, all 50 girls in the class were pregnant. So that was my high school solution to kind of an out of sight, out of mind thing. If you got pregnant, you suddenly enrolled in cosmetology. You went down in the basement, and instead of having to travel the halls pregnant, they would bring the various teachers to you, the math teacher, the English teacher, whatever. So,
what years were those?
I graduated in 81. So that probably would have been in 79.
I promise you that has changed.
I'm sure it has.
And they probably now have a daycare center for no, I'm serious. A daycare center in the school for the babies because that happens a whole lot. What you were raising when you talk about solutions, which you initially asked, this is a perfect example. Here we have something where, on the one hand, being a single mother is tough. And sympathizing with all the women out there who are doing their best to raise their children under difficult circumstances, that's completely natural to do that. On the other hand, it is simply a statement of fact. And I'll tell you, people who are academicians on the left know this to be true as well. Children don't do nearly as well in single mother families as they do in two-parent families, statistically. That doesn't mean that there aren't a lot of kids who grew up in single-mother families who do great. It does mean that statistically, this is a big, big social problem. And so what do you do? People don't want to be nasty. They don't want to dump on women who are already faced with a tough situation. On the other hand, how do you discourage a behavior that's a problem like this unless you penalize it? It's the great dilemma. And in this case, let's face it, we are not going to reinstitute a case where girls who get pregnant are sent out of town to have the babies. It's just not going to happen.
I wasn't suggesting that we should, but
no, and you—I know you weren't. But what can we do? Well, this leads me to my reasons for writing this book, Coming Apart, which is I think that we start by recognizing the nature of the problem, because right now people don't. We've been talking about the problem of single parent families, and you and I are pretty much in the same wavelength. I assure you, the conversation would have been very different with most other radio hosts. What we need to do is say, look, you don't have to dislike single mothers to say out loud, to bring a baby into the world that you are not financially or emotionally or otherwise prepared to care for is wrong. It's not just a mistake. It's not just a life choice. It's wrong because bringing a child into the world is the most important thing that most of us ever do in our whole lives. And we ought to be ready to say that out loud, not in a punitive way, but to reestablish what the right and wrong of this behavior is. And the same thing should apply to a wide variety of other things, where simply saying out loud that we are willing to make judgments is going to be a big step forward.
Well, I think you know how much our present-day society discourages making judgments. That's something that's sort of gone out the window, and I've even heard people say, well, with regard to making judgments, that gossip can be a good thing because it reinforces social norms. And there was a time when there was a tremendous amount of chatter that was created by one of these situations that we're talking about, but as I mentioned earlier, now these situations seem to be embraced. One of the things that I always find interesting is that when I talk to someone from the left, and I do invite people on the left to come on the show, very few accept, but when they do come on, is that they talk about single motherhood as well as abortion as being something that, you know, has empowered women. And I think all they're really allowing here is for males to impregnate females without responsibility. I mean, the father's almost being removed from the equation. It's almost an afterthought. Am I off base with that? Or
no, and here again, we are looking at a change in the culture where we now have class divisions we didn't used to have. Remember I said a few minutes ago that you have a whole lot of adult males now who aren't even looking for work, and this is before the recession. What are they doing? Well, they're not necessarily evil people. They can be nice guys you'd like to go out and have a beer with, but they can't quite get their act together. You know, they got a job and they can't hold on to it. So what do? They go live with their sister. And their sister's trying to raise a family and so forth. Sister takes them in, and they live off them. Or they go to the girlfriend, and they live off the girlfriend. And once again, if you live, I mean, I live in a rural blue-collar community myself. If you go to a rural blue-collar community, or for that matter, urban ones, that is not a fiction. We all know people like that. Well, if it happens to one family in town, that's a stress on that one family. When it's happening to lots of families in town, it's a stress on the community. That isn't going on in the upper middle class. I'm not trying to hold up the upper middle class as being paragons, but the fact is that doesn't happen nearly as much. And so I want to say to them, and by upper middle class I mean professionals and managers and things like that, I want to say to them, for heaven's sakes, preach what you practice. You're getting married. You're supporting yourselves. You're working long hours. You're taking care of your kids. For heaven's sake, start to say, this is a good way to live your life. And this ought to be the norm for everybody. Be a step forward.
And you know what? I'll join in on that right now. Yesterday, my wife and I celebrated our 25th anniversary.
Right.
And we are very, very proud to have held on to our marriage when most of our friends, or I shouldn't say most, but when a number of people we went to high school have been married 2-3 times. In fact, one lady that we know that my wife went to high school with had been married so many times she could no longer legally get married in the state of Texas. So she had to
go outside. How many times is that?
I think it's 6. Yeah,
wow.
So she had to leave the state in order to get hitched a 7th time, I believe. I'm not positive on those numbers, but it was something in that area. So, yeah, it does need to be celebrated. It really does. I think that we live in sort of a disposable society in terms of everything from the containers we purchase our food products and drink products in. And unfortunately, it seems like along with televisions and computers and everything else, that maybe marriage has become somewhat disposable, or spouses have become somewhat disposable as well.
And once I will simply say that that is true for part of America, mm-hmm. and in another part of America, long, stable marriages are the norm. They're still the norm. That's what I mean by this cultural division. Almost anything that we say about America, American institutions such as religion and work and marriage, it depends on what part of America you're talking about as to whether you have a problem. And that's really what the new book is trying to say, that we have this division that a lot of people haven't recognized.
Well, some people are going to hear this and say, you know, when I watch television, all the big stars, J-Lo and, you know, you name the favorite Hollywood Tinseltown person, they've all been married multiple times. They get married every few years. And, you know, this isn't really something that's just impacting the lower classes. This is something that you see of the elite. Take a look at Newt Gingrich. I mean, you know.
Well, yeah.
he's actually been on the show. We didn't mention that day though. But at any rate, it's a lot of people would argue that, you know, we see that with the elite as well.
Well, let me give you an anecdote. A couple of years ago, before I worked on the book, I was teaching a seminar at American Enterprise Institute where I work, and this was about 18 Colgate students. Colgate being a pretty good college in New York, at private college. So they were sitting around the room, and I wanted to talk about marital breakdown. And I myself have been divorced. And so I said to the class, I said, okay, just to get a sense of where we fit with all of this, would you please raise your hand if you come from a home where you are no longer living with both your biological mother and father? And I said, I'll start by raising my hand as a man who's a father of such a home. Out of those 18 kids, one had come from a home where they were not still living with the biological mother and father. And, of course, I immediately was just embarrassed as could be that I'd had this one girl raise her hand and embarrassed her. But I said, is that possible? Is it possible you can have 18 kids in America today and 17 of them are still living with their mother and father? And so I started going to the statistics. And, Mark, that was what got me going on what you now have in the book, Coming Apart, which is an understanding that if I were talking about the children of professionals and upper-level managers, statistically, that was a pretty normal class.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right, J-Lo. You know, I don't know if she was married when she had her baby. I wouldn't be surprised if she wasn't. what you say about celebrities is absolutely true. But very quietly in these upper middle class neighborhoods around the country, including in College Station, you go to those zip codes with the highest median income and the highest levels of education, and you're going to find an awful lot of people there who are still married to the same people that they started with.
Well,
I know, it's surprising. It is surprising.
But one of my favorite stories is that a little boy who lived a few houses down from my in-laws came home from the first day of school and asked his parents why he didn't have a stepmother or a stepfather because all the other kids seemed to have one.
Yeah, and that is you're talking about. I was talking about the working class and the upper middle class. Well, there's also a great big middle class in between that, which is bigger than both of them. And I would imagine that a lot of the kids in the school that you're talking about were middle class.
Correct.
And the problems with marriage and so forth, they are not as bad in the middle class as they are in the working class, but they're getting there. Mm. They're deteriorating really fast.
Well, in the time we have left, tell the folks at home how they can get a hold of a copy of this book, because I know they're going to be interested in wanting to read it.
The easiest way is to go to Amazon. I don't know about you, but I get almost all my books on Amazon. The name of the book is Coming Apart, The State of White America, 1960 to 2010. And they also have e-books, so you can get a Kindle copy of it, or you can get it from Apple's iTunes store as well.
Fantastic. It's certainly interesting material. I'm guessing perhaps a little bit controversial, but then again, you're no stranger to controversy based on some of your past books. Maybe we will have you back sometime soon, and we can just sort of discuss several of your books at once.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Dr. Murray. It's an honor to have you on the show today.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar.